Thanks for joining us. I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. Diane will be back on the air tomorrow. 6 years ago, Washington Post reporter Alan Cyprus was intrigued by how quickly avian flu swept through Asian countries, such as China, Vietnam, and Cambodia. Like a detective, he followed the trail of the virus from family-owned poultry farms to street markets and cockfighting venues. In a new book, he shows why the battle between man and microbe goes beyond the laboratory and petri dish. Researchers are up against ancient superstitions, local politics, and international economics. His book is titled The Fatal Strain: On the Trail of Avian Flu and the Coming Pandemic. And he joins me in the studio. Welcome to the Diane Rehm Show.
Thanks so much for having me.
We invite our listeners to join our conversation. Our toll-free number, 1-800-433-8850. You can always send us an email at drshow@wamu.org. Well, your book is very well timed, given all the concern we have these days about the swine flu. These flu pandemics are threatened flu pandemics. Is this a pretty modern occurrence?
No, there have been flu pandemics as far back in history as history has been recorded. It's only over the last few centuries that scientists and researchers have been able to track their actual progress. But what we're seeing now, for instance, with swine flu is just a repeat of what we've seen periodically over many centuries.
I wonder if when the ancient Greeks and others wrote about plagues, with the benefit of some hindsight, could those have been the flu?
It's very possible they could have been. We don't have, obviously, all the epidemiological information they had or the lab results, but yeah, it's quite possible.
When it comes to the avian flu, which you write about to a great extent in your new book, Asia seems to be at the center of it as a starting point. Why is Asia often the starting point for these flus?
Well, that's a great question. In fact, China, and particularly southern China, has been the cradle for a lot of flu epidemics over the years. There are a number of theories, but one centers on Chinese agriculture. A number of centuries ago, the Chinese used to graze their ducks in remote canals, but as part of their agricultural progress, they decided they could actually graze the ducks, which are natural carriers, natural hosts for the flu virus. They could graze them in the rice paddies between harvests. That would clear out all the pests, clear out all the husks. The ducks would get fattened up, and so it would be a win-win for the local villagers. But what it did is it brought the ducks, who, as I said, are the natural hosts for the influenza virus, into villages where they lived cheek and jowl with the villagers, with pigs, with other animals where the virus could breed. And so we've seen periodically over the years that kind of agricultural reform or change now give rise to quite a number of pandemics.
In fact, you write that all flu viruses emanate from birds. Why is that?
Well, viruses, different types of viruses pick different types of animals as their hosts. Water birds, and particularly wild water birds, have been the natural hosts for flu viruses. It's actually unusual to see flu get into chickens. And that's it's happened from time to time in the past. But one of the things that's really striking is how it's now settled in chickens across Asia and Africa and other places at times as well.
So your book has in its subtitle, The Coming Pandemic. What is a pandemic?
A pandemic is simply an epidemic that circles the world. That's the definition.
So is the swine flu now a pandemic?
It is. Swine flu is the first pandemic of the 21st century. It is severe for those people who die of it, but for most of us, it's a fairly mild disease. It's really no worse than seasonal flu in most cases. So you can have moderate or mild pandemics. We had one with the Hong Kong flu back in the 60s. We had one with the Asian flu back in the 50s. Swine flu reminds us that flu pandemics can happen. What it hasn't reminded us yet, though, is how bad they can be. And for that, we need to go back to the 1918 Spanish flu to really see.
The 1918 Spanish flu, the great influenza of 1918, killed at least 50 million people worldwide, killed more Americans than all the wars of the last 100 years combined.
It was a staggering event. It affected communities not only across this country, but remote places around the world. Islands in the South Pacific that were only reached by several days' travel by slow boats back then, saw thousands of people killed by the Spanish flu. Eskimo villages in the most remote outposts of Alaska were largely wiped out.
Why was it so deadly?
Well, it's not that it was particularly contagious. It was very contagious, but all flu viruses are contagious. What was different about the Spanish flu was how lethal it was, the kind of attack it launched on the lungs of the people who caught it. It just devastated the respiratory system, and it preyed particularly not on those who usually get sick with flu, the very young or the very old, but it preyed upon those who were the healthiest, those in the early and middle parts of their lives. And that's what made Spanish flu so scary, and it's also what avian flu seems to do to its victims.
We've been very sad to see some deaths from swine flu, but the mortality rate for swine flu is pretty low. You warn that that could change if something happens. What is it that you think is the great risk that comes with swine flu?
Well, there are a number of risks with swine flu, certainly. There's the risk, for instance, that it could develop resistance to Tamiflu, which is the drug of choice for treating it. It could continue to spread and overwhelm the ICUs in our hospitals. But the real nightmare scenario, what worries disease specialists the most, is that swine flu will meet up with bird flu, and they will swap genetic material. This is by no means sure, but just the possibility this could happen really is unnerving.
And why would that be so serious?
Well, flu viruses are rather rare among viruses. They're promiscuous. They have the ability to swap segments of their genetic material. And when they do, they can also trade the attributes that go with that genetic material. So, for instance, if bird flu and swine flu were to meet up, you could have a virus that is as contagious as swine flu, which is quite contagious, we've seen, but also as lethal as bird flu. Now, bird flu is still very, very hard to contract. But when you get it, it's likely you'll die. Bird flu now kills more than half of those who catch it. And so a reassorted virus, scientists call it reassortment, a reassorted virus that has the lethality of bird flu and the transmissibility of swine flu would be horrible.
Is there anything that can be done to make it less likely that this happens?
I mean, what you would want to do, obviously, is to limit the spread of those viruses. There's limited possibility to do that. Vaccination, certainly for swine flu, can reduce the number of people who are susceptible. But at the end of the day, I think the viruses are in the driver's seat for this one.
And so tell me, what should people, you know, people who hear this terrible scenario, this worst-case scenario describe, what can they do about it? Is there anything?
There's not much you really can do. You know, as a society, as a country, swine flu has offered us a couple of lessons. It's told us we need to get much more serious about vaccine development. We use a technology now that dates from the 1950s where vaccine strains are grown in chicken eggs. Swine flu has also told us that we need to be more serious about our pandemic planning. I mean, swine flu may not be all that serious, and yet we're already in danger of seeing our hospitals overwhelmed. And so... there's nothing we can do in particular to prepare for this reassorted virus, which is a worst-case scenario. It's not necessarily the likely scenario, but the worst-case scenario. But we can, as a society, do more to just prepare for pandemics.
So rate for us how first the Bush administration and then the Obama administration has done in responding to the threat of swine flu.
In terms of the threat of pandemic flu in general, we saw the Bush administration begin to get increasingly serious about that threat, in particular because of what was happening out in Asia with avian flu. We saw more money put into the development of vaccines, more money put into the development and stockpiling of antiviral drugs. We saw some pandemic planning take place. The Obama administration has responded, I think, vigorously and with goodwill. If there was any shortcoming, it was that they promised that vaccines would be here sooner and in larger quantities than we've actually seen happen. They probably would have been smarter to underpromise and overdeliver.
What do you think they should be doing now? Are there additional steps that ought to be being taken to protect Americans?
Against swine flu in particular?
Mm-hmm.
Well, much of the problem they have right now is a communications problem. They're trying to convince the public to go ahead and get vaccinated because there are quite a number of people out there who are suspicious of vaccines. At the same time, there are other people who are clamoring to get vaccines for themselves and for their children, and they're having trouble finding them. They're waiting in very, very long lines. And so it's an issue now of managing the message. I'm not sure there's much they could do right now to deal with the immediate emergency that swine flu presents.
You know, this was not a situation that was predicted for in advance. Why? It seemed to come kind of out of the blue. Why was that?
Well, that's exactly right. You know, most experts were watching Asia. That's where they were looking for the pandemic to emerge. They were on edge because of avian flu. It had been spreading in Asian countries. Efforts by governments in Asia to try to eradicate it kept falling short. The virus kept coming back. The lethality, the deadliness of that avian flu virus was really making people quite nervous if, in fact, it could break the pandemic code. And then suddenly, earlier this year, we saw something completely different. We saw a swine flu strain emerge in the southwestern U.S. and in Mexico. And what that showed us is that when it comes to flu, the only thing that's predictable is how unpredictable it actually is.
Why did it seem to come first out of Mexico and the southwest United States?
Well, that's certainly where the first cases were identified and the first cases were confirmed. Did swine flu actually first cross from animals into humans there? I'm not sure. I mean, there's some research that shows, and it's very speculative, that in fact this strain too may have first crossed from animals to people, crossed the species divide in Asia. But we don't know for sure. We do a very, very poor job of monitoring the development of viruses in livestock. And so when this thing finally hit people, we weren't quite sure where it came from.
Alan Cypress is author of a new book. It's called The Fatal Strain: On the Trail of Avian Flu and the Coming Pandemic. He's deputy economics editor at The Washington Post. He served as the paper's Southeast Asia correspondent when the avian flu first emerged as a big issue. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll go to the phones, 1-800-433-8850, or send us an email, drshow@wamu.org. Stay with us. Welcome back. I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. Alan Cypress is with me in the studio. He's author of The Fatal Strain: On the Trail of Avian Flu and the Coming Pandemic. We're going to go to the phones in just a moment. But first, let's talk about some of the political responses we've seen to the avian flu and to the swine flu. You've written about Indonesia's former health minister who refused to turn over virus specimens to the World Health Organization. Why?
Well, it's a very serious issue. The health minister at the time, Siti Fadila Supari, was concerned that Indonesia was providing virus samples to the world, which were then being converted into vaccines against avian flu, and then being sold back to the developing world at prices that those countries just couldn't afford. These are countries that are already strapped for fighting the everyday health problems they face, whether it's malaria or parasites or dengue. And now they were providing the world with what she considered a biological resource and being forced to pay first world prices.
And so has this situation been resolved?
No, it hasn't. There have been negotiations going on for several years, first between WHO, the World Health Organization, and Indonesia, and then the United States and other countries got involved as well. And there continues to be a standoff. So until today, we continue to see Indonesia withholding virus specimens that the world needs to monitor the progress of the virus, the changes or mutation of the virus.
Why does the world need those from Indonesia in particular?
Well, the virus is deeply entrenched in much of Indonesia right now. It has spread to just about all of the 33 provinces in Indonesia. And specialists say that if there's any place on Earth where avian flu is most likely to emerge, it very well could be Indonesia. And yet we're blind to what's happening in Indonesia at the moment, because Indonesia, again, isn't providing the specimens that the world needs to see how the virus might be changing, or to prepare tests for the virus, or to develop a vaccine against the virus.
There are, of course, repercussions or potential consequences from the swine flu that go beyond the medical, beyond the effect on people who get sick or even die. For instance, political consequences or economic consequences. You're the economics editor at the Washington Post. What are some of the economic consequences?
Of swine flu.
Of swine flu or of flu pandemics in general.
Right. Well, swine flu has the potential, of course, to keep people home, to keep them from going to work. And that's a real issue. If we see this pandemic continue to build and we continue to see more people get sick, we're going to see absenteeism go up at a lot of companies. And that makes it hard for the economy to keep functioning. The economy will do fine with a pandemic of this nature. In fact, there's some concern right now that some people will continue coming to work even if they are sick, because they don't get the kind of sick days that they need at their companies, and they're penalized if they take too many sick days. So now we see some companies, some businesses perhaps, where people are coming to work and potentially infecting their customers or their coworkers. But if this were a far more serious pandemic, if this were an avian flu pandemic, then we could see the economy actually start to buckle. And part of the reason for that is that we are so dependent as a country now on supplies that come from overseas, that if international trade were upset, then a lot of the things we count on here, including medicines for things that have nothing to do with flu, would come to a halt.
I don't think we'd see a threat to political stability in the United States from even a more serious flu pandemic. But what about around the world? Are there places where this could have political consequences?
You know, this was one of my biggest concerns when I was based in Southeast Asia. If a flu pandemic, a serious flu pandemic, broke out in some of the countries of Southeast Asia, I was afraid of the kind of civil strife we might see. There wouldn't be the drugs that people needed to fight it. There wouldn't be vaccine. And what would happen when different groups started fighting among themselves, trying to get that? Or people were getting sick and the hospitals couldn't accommodate it. How would the governments out there, who in many cases already have problems of credibility, problems of staying in power, how would they address civil violence, those growing demands from their own populations? And how would, for instance, the expatriate community out there, what would we have done had people started knocking on our windows and doors and asking for what supplies we did have?
Let's go to the phones and let some of our listeners join our conversation. We'll go first to New Market, Maryland, and talk to Elaine. Elaine, thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me. I guess I'm just getting a little concerned about this current pandemic. It sounds to me like the pandemic on steroids right now, the way that fear, the way that it's characterized. It's the same H1N1 virus that was a pandemic that killed lots of people in 1918, but it does not have that kind of kill rate now. Millions of people have gotten this flu and survived. You know, we keep talking about the 4,000 that died, but if you set that up against millions that have survived, this is just not the hysteria that I'm hearing surrounding this in the news. It's just not justified. My own son has had it. The kids in his school have had it. No one has died that I know of here in New Market. Last year, I've heard of two people locally that died of just the regular flu that went around last year. So I guess my concern is just, you know, he said that the immediate, even you quoted, immediate emergency. I don't see this as an immediate emergency, this particular flu.
All right, Elaine, thanks for your call, and we're glad that your son has gotten over having the swine flu himself. Well, have we overreacted to the threat here, do you think, Alan?
I don't think we've overreacted, but I would agree with your caller on several counts. There is absolutely no reason to panic about H1N1 swine flu right now. It is, for the majority of people, the large majority of people who get it, something they recover from. It is not just like a common cold, however. I know people who've caught it. It's knocked them on their backs for several days. They've run high fevers. It's very unpleasant. And in fact, flu is very unpleasant. Seasonal flu is very unpleasant, and it also kills more people than we realize. Many of them are over the age of 65, but it's a killer for them as well. Again, I wouldn't panic, but I'd bear a few things in mind. One is we really don't understand we really don't understand how this virus works because it's so new yet. It attacks a different part of the demographic than most viruses attack, and we don't fully understand why that's the case either. It's hitting the younger rather than the old. And because we also don't know how it might change. We may see a third wave of this virus in a few months from now. We had one in the spring. We have one now. We may have a third one in the spring. It could be worse. It might not be worse, but we don't know. And again, because it's so new, we really are gambling. And then finally, what would happen if this virus mutated into a form that was resistant to Tamiflu? That's the drug that's being used for the people who get the worst cases. And if that tool were taken out of the toolbox, then we would have a problem.
What would happen then?
Well, there are other drugs that could be used, but we've already seen with Tamiflu, for instance, a shortage of children's Tamiflu. I'm not sure there'd be nearly enough drug to treat the people who end up in the hospital with serious cases.
Now, we've gotten a call from Patricia from Rockville, Maryland, who says she's healthy and has gotten a flu shot and is close to 70 years old. I think she means she's gotten a seasonal flu shot. And she's asking, should she get the H1N1 vaccine?
Well, right now, the elderly are not considered among the high priority groups. Right now, the CDC is recommending that the very young or people with underlying health conditions or pregnant women get the vaccine. So the caller needn't be lining up at this point. But in general, I think it is a good idea, if someone wants to be vaccinated, to go ahead and get that vaccine. It's an added level of protection.
Let's go to Indianapolis and talk to Roy. Roy, you're on the Diane Rehm Show.
Oh, thank you for listening, or for answering. yes, my question was, I keep hearing that the swine flu is all new and that, but in 1976, on Monument Circle in Indianapolis, they gave out 2,000-3,000 shots. I worked downtown at that time, and I actually got it then. Of course, VA says I should get a booster for it, but they keep saying it's something new. The swine flu's new, and it's been around for some time. Any comments?
All right, Roy, thanks for your call.
Well, there are various strains of swine flu. We call it swine flu because it tends to come out of pigs. But there are various strains of swine flu. And as the previous caller said as well, this H1N1, in fact, is related to the H1N1 that struck in 1918. But the H1N1 swine flu we see now is sufficiently different that it's not clear we have natural immunity to it. And as I said earlier, it contains different genetic material than previous strains have had. And what it could do, we still don't fully understand.
Roy mentions the experience in 1976 when there was warnings about swine flu. President Ford at the time tried to get the American people to kind of mobilize to fight it. Are there lessons from our experience then?
There may be a few lessons. Of course, there was quite a backlash against the efforts to vaccinate against swine flu in 1976. There were quite a number of instances of what appeared to be side effects. And if there's a lesson, we never really scrubbed what happened in 1976 with the vaccine program. We don't fully understand what went wrong, if anything in fact went wrong. It's never been communicated to the public. And so some of the suspicion we see today about vaccinating against swine flu and some of the suspicion we may see against vaccinating against bird flu if it happens arise from the fact that we never clarified for the public precisely what went wrong, if anything, in 76.
In fact, polling shows a high proportion of parents saying they don't want their children to get the swine flu vaccine. Are they right to be suspicious, or do you think they should allow their children to be vaccinated?
I think both those things are true. I certainly think they should get their children vaccinated. I think the folks right now who are recommending that children get vaccinated against swine flu are very good at what they do. They're very smart. They have expertise that we don't have. People do make mistakes. Institutions do make mistakes. There should always be a dose of suspicion when evaluating these kind of recommendations. But I'm humble enough to know that I don't know nearly as much about these matters as they do. And in this case, I would certainly trust their judgment.
Do you have kids?
I do.
And have they been vaccinated?
She has.
And how about yourself?
I haven't been vaccinated because I'm not one of the priority groups, but I'm looking forward to getting that vaccine.
Let's go to Mike. He's calling us from West Palm Beach, Florida. Hi, Mike.
Hi, how you doing?
Good.
Question for Alan. Initially, you mentioned earlier in the show that the swine flu was a transfer from, you say, some animal, pig, to human?
Yes.
Is that true?
Yes.
And so how does that occur?
That's a tremendous question. We don't know precisely how this virus got from pigs into people. In fact, this virus itself is just a remarkable puzzle. This virus includes the mixture of two different swine viruses, one that circulates among pigs in the Western Hemisphere and one that circulates among pigs in the Eastern Hemisphere. How they ever met up, we're not sure. But then the one that circulates among pigs in the Western Hemisphere itself is the result of a mixture of viruses that circulate among people, birds, and pigs. It's created just this puzzle that people are dying to solve, and we don't understand how it all came together. But it does underscore the ability with which flu viruses can remake themselves time and time again.
But if pigs have a flu virus, how does it jump to humans?
Well, we do know that in cases of other cases of swine flu, farm workers who've worked with pigs have caught the flu that the pigs had. Pigs and other animals get sick, and like us, they sneeze, they cough, you catch it.
I'm Susan Page, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. We're taking your calls at 1-800-433-8850 and reading your emails. You can send them to drshow@wamu.org. Well, let's talk about how the Chinese responded when there was growing evidence of the spread of a flu-like disease back in about 2002. It turned out not to be the flu. It turned out to be SARS. But how did the Chinese government respond to that situation?
To the outbreak of SARS?
Mm-hmm.
Well, the Chinese for months sought to cover up the outbreak of what later turned out to be SARS. There were rumors circulating for a number of months that there was a strange respiratory disease spreading in southern China. The Chinese said it was nothing unusual. When the world asked for information, they didn't provide it. When the world asked for samples of the virus that was spreading, the Chinese for the longest time didn't provide them. And in fact, it fell to a scientist in Hong Kong, Dr. Yi Guan, to smuggle samples of that virus from Guangzhou into Hong Kong, where his lab was located. And at the time, he thought it was bird flu beginning to break out, that the bird flu pandemic was starting to spread. Ultimately found out it wasn't bird flu, but it was SARS.
Why were the Chinese so resistant to acknowledging what was happening?
Well, part of it is the nature of an authoritarian state trying to control bad news. Part of it, I believe, was that local health authorities didn't want to report up the chain of command because of the criticism they themselves might face. With swine flu, I must say, the Chinese have been much, much more aggressive. In fact, some people would say they've been overzealous. They've put into place travel restrictions. They've put in place quarantine for people who are suspected with the case. So, in fact, some people say the Chinese steps may have actually curbed the spread of swine flu in China. Personally, I'm skeptical that that's true. And in fact, we know that until today, the Chinese are less than transparent about what's happening with bird flu as it continues to circulate in their animals.
Going back to the experience with SARS in China, were there consequences because the Chinese denied for so long that something was going on?
Well, there were consequences for the world, no doubt. By the time the Chinese came clean about what had happened, the virus had spread from Guangzhou into Hong Kong, and it had then taken off like a shotgun shot around the world. It had traveled from plane to Canada. It had traveled to Mongolia. It had ricocheted back. It had spread from country to country, and there was no containing it. Now, to be honest, I'm not sure if they'd been honest, whether we would have been able to contain it. It still might have spread, but the world would have known what it was sooner, would have started preparing for it sooner, might have figured out how to treat it sooner, and might have developed, if need be, a vaccine for it sooner.
So looking at the swine flu situation today, what parts of the world are suffering the most?
From swine flu at this moment, we are beginning to see the pandemic really accelerate in Northern Europe. The number of cases there has been growing very rapidly. In the United States, there's some early indications that perhaps it's peaked in parts of the country. But again, the information we get changes from week to week.
If it's peaked, does that mean people can stop worrying about it?
No, they can't, because, again, we don't know if there's going to be another wave in a few months from now. We also don't know if we're seeing a false peak. It may be that it's laid low for a week or two, and it finds a new group of susceptible people and accelerates again.
The CDC put out numbers last week about the number of new deaths, 535 new deaths in 51 countries for the previous week. How do they make these estimates on how many people are suffering from and dying from the swine flu?
It's very, very difficult. You know, many countries have stopped counting cases already. Here in the United States, we've stopped counting most cases. Most people don't even get tested for it. There's an assumption if you have something that looks like flu now, it's almost certainly swine flu because swine flu has crowded out other forms of flu. When they're counting deaths, they're now counting those folks that are confirmed to have the virus, but also people who may have died of other things such as bacterial infections or organ failure related to what seems to have come from the virus.
Alan Cyprus's new book is called The Fatal Strain. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll go back to the phones and take some of your calls and questions. Stay with us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the German Embassy, presenting Germany Info, a web publication with daily news from Germany, business and investment information, and suggestions for travel to Europe, on the web at germany.info. From the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, your source for what works in public education. Learn more at edutopia.org. And by the Ford Foundation, working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide, at fordfoundation.org. This is NPR.
On the next Fresh Air, actor Woody Harrelson.
Fame is a funny animal that you got to wrestle with in your own way. Sometimes you wrestle it to a standstill, and sometimes it gets you by the throat.
His new film is The Messenger. Also, Josh Cosman, author of The Buyout of America, How Private Equity Will Cause the Next Great Credit Crisis. Join us.
We've gotten an email from Shoshana, writing us from Raleigh, North Carolina. She says, please do not use the swine flu moniker. People have stopped eating pork because they think they can contract this flu by eating pork. Can you contract this flu by eating pork?
Not as far as I know.
But do you have any problem calling it the swine flu?
No, I don't.
We have had gotten several emails from people wondering about whether the kind of farming we have in this country has contributed to this problem. One of them is from Louisa, who writes us from State College, Pennsylvania. She says, how much do you feel that the factory-style farming of animals raised in tight quarters and with poor hygiene has contributed or could contribute to the rise of these new flu strains?
That's a great question. There is no doubt that the rise of intensive agriculture, livestock breeding, has really contributed to the chances of pandemic flu. Let me talk a little bit about what's been happening in Asia, since Asia seems to be the cradle for a lot of these flu pandemics. Over the last generation, we've seen Asian societies become much, much richer as the Asian economic miracle took place. Places like Thailand, places like Indonesia, places like Vietnam, people have become much richer. We've seen the emergence of a broad middle class, and those middle class people want better diets. They want more protein. That's created a tremendous demand for animal protein, ducks, chickens, pigs. And as a result, we've seen just a remarkable change in the nature of agriculture in these countries. We've seen what used to be dirt-poor farmers now raising hundreds and thousands of birds crammed together, often under unsanitary conditions. If a virus gets into those conditions, it can spread like a spark in dry timber and then explode outward into some of these large population centers in Asia. So there's no doubt that the rise of intensified, crowded, large-scale agriculture in places like Asia and China are creating perfect storm conditions for the outbreak of a pandemic.
Well, we have those kind of large-scale farming operations in the United States as well. Has this been a problem here?
Well, with the farming here in this country, certainly there's the potential for viruses to take hold because, again, you have large populations. You often have animals with not a lot of genetic diversity, which means that it's more likely the virus could take hold and spread in that population. At the same time, we've seen agriculture in this country, at least as compared to many places in Asia, adopt forms of biosecurity. That means they've tried to close off their farms from the outside. Often people who have to go into the farms have to sterilize themselves, wear special clothes. You don't move livestock from one site to another site without making sure that you're taking sanitary steps. So if I were given my choice between what's happening in this country and what I saw firsthand in Asia, I'm more comfortable with what's happening here.
Now, you write also about some ripple effects when, during the avian flu crisis, there were efforts to wipe out some of these chicken farms and others that were contributing to the problem. What happened?
Well, there were certainly efforts to try to stamp out infected flocks. But the bigger problem isn't so much that there wasn't adequate culling. It was that in country after country, we saw the governments lie about the outbreaks that they had. We talked a little bit about what the Chinese did during SARS. Well, the Chinese covered up their outbreaks of bird flu until the virus repeatedly spread to other neighboring countries and even winged its way westward to Europe in wildfowl. We saw the Indonesians cover it up because the agricultural industry in Indonesia leaned on the agriculture ministry and the head of government, Megawati Sukarno-Putri, to not reveal that they had an outbreak. We saw the Vietnamese cover it up for months. We saw the Thai government, which was well aware that this virus was spreading in its flocks, lie about it until an elderly virologist himself blew the whistle after he'd sleuthed out the cause of the outbreaks. So in country after country, we've seen local heroes blow the whistle before the government themselves are willing to do it.
You've talked about several scientists who did kind of risky things, including with the SARS epidemic. What happened to the scientist in China who stepped forward to try to expose the SARS epidemic in China?
Well, certainly he came in for a whole lot of criticism after he did that. More recently, we've seen a scientist that I talked about, Dr. Yi Guan, in Hong Kong, who had built a network of people in southern China who were taking samples from birds to monitor the spread of the virus. We've seen the Chinese government close down his network, close down one of his research institutes on the mainland, because they were so upset that he was telling the truth, that he was actually getting word out about how the virus was spreading. And in fact, many of the samples, thousands of the samples of bird flu virus that scientists now work with, originated from the efforts of Dr. Yi Guan in Hong Kong.
Let's read an email from Sandra. She writes us from Athens, Ohio. She says, earlier this month, there was a swine flu outbreak among my daughter's gymnastic teammates. Those who became ill in return still had a weakened immune system, and some of them picked up the strep. My question is this: has the swine flu created a scenario in which other germs such as strep thrive and turn into superbugs?
Well, that's a very, very good question. And I'm not sure what the latest research shows on that. Certainly that we've seen people who've been sickened with swine flu then pick up a variety of bacterial infections or in very serious cases see their organs fail, which can even lead to death. But whether in fact makes you more susceptible to something like strep, I'm going to have to defer to the researchers on that one.
Let's talk to Robert. He's calling us from Arlington, Virginia. And here's his question. If there are several different strains of the swine flu? Why do they all have the same designation, H1N1? And what do those letters and numbers mean?
Well, good question. There are a variety of strains that all share the designation, H1N1. The H stands for protein on the surface of the flu virus. The H stands for hemagglutinin. And that is the protein that that allows the virus to break into the human cell, where it can then reproduce and multiply. The N stands for neuraminidase. That's another protein on the surface of the flu virus, and that allows the flu virus to break loose and then spread back out into the population. We know that there are different types of hemagglutinin and different types of neuraminidase, and each one is given a number to designate it. So an H1N1 has the H1 type and the N1 type of those proteins. H5N1, which is bird flu, has a different type of hemagglutinin protein, but has the same type of neuraminidase. However, there are other genes that are involved, other bits and pieces of the flu virus that are involved in determining precisely what the strain is. And those are not on the surface of the virus, but inside. And those are very different from one H1 and one strain to another.
We're having a little trouble with the phones, and so I'm going to be reading more emails. We're trying to get the phone system fixed so that we can come back to some of our callers. Here's an email from Susan who writes, why are vaccines available in some states like Virginia versus almost no availability in Monroe County, New York? Now, I'm guessing that Susan is from Monroe County, New York. Why can you get the flu vaccine some places and not others?
The problem is with the distribution system. I mean, not only don't we have an adequate capacity for producing flu vaccines in this country, but we really don't have a very good network for distributing them as well. Even here in the District of Columbia, where I live, I've seen some clinics get the vaccine and other clinics not. I've seen some schools where they've had clinics get enough and others not. And so it's a problem with the distribution network through which the government is trying to push out its vaccine.
Well, is the system worked fairly, do you think? Or are there problems with some areas being able to have easier access than others?
Well, no one has adequate access. Even in places where the vaccine is available, I've heard stories of very, very long lines. Again, here in the District of Columbia, where I live, we waited online over 3 hours to get the flu vaccine for my child. And we've had, you know, a pretty good supply.
Now, here's an email from Barbara. She writes, I am really disgusted that some Wall Street firms receive supplies of the vaccine ahead of priority groups. I know there was some stories about Goldman Sachs, for one, getting some supplies. She writes, I know distribution is administered by the states. What were the requirements of HHS for employees? Did they have to fit the priority groups?
Yes. Employees who got the shots through those Wall Street firms, got those vaccines, did have to meet the criteria for those who were considered a priority. I mean, when I first heard this as well, I thought, you know, these firms have already come in for such criticism for their outsized bonuses and for what they did in the walk-up to the financial crisis. And now here they are, they're getting special treatment for vaccine against swine flu. And in fact, when we looked into it, we found out that quite a number of employers have gotten access to the vaccine to give it to people who actually are considered priority. So what I hear, if you're a healthy banker or a top Goldman Sachs, you're probably not getting this vaccine. But if you're a pregnant woman, you might be.
You write in your book about flu researchers who came together in 1997 in Hong Kong. Now, this was before avian flu was known to be, you know, a factor in Asia. Were they very foresighted, this group of scientists?
Well, what happened was in 1997, we saw the first instance in which bird flu jumped from birds to people. We've known that bird flu is in birds. It was supposed to stay there. And then suddenly we had a case in the first half of 1997 where a young boy got very sick. And then we saw more than a dozen cases later in the year in Hong Kong. And researchers from around the world, but particularly from the CDC in Atlanta here in the U.S., raced out there because there was real fear that we were starting to see the beginning of a flu pandemic, and not any old flu pandemic. This flu seemed to be attacking people the same way that the 1918 Spanish flu was as well. So people were shocked that the virus had jumped from birds to people, and they were terrified by how it was attacking.
We talk over and over again about this 1918 flu, which, of course, was so incredibly tragic. Would we have the same kind of situation now? Would we have the same lack of defenses that people had in 1918, which led to this enormous death toll then?
Well, in some ways we're better off, and in some ways we're worse off. And certainly we have a more advanced medical system. We have better communication to prepare for a pandemic. We have antibiotics to treat bacterial infections that may arise from from flu cases, but in other ways, we're actually more vulnerable than we were in 1918. As I mentioned a bit earlier, our economy has become so globalized that a lot of the drugs we need to treat not just flu, but for instance, heart disease, diabetes, and the like, come from overseas. And we could see death again on a scale we're not accustomed to if we get a virus along the lines of 1918.
I'm Susan Page, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. We're going to try again to go back to the phones and see if they work. Chad is calling us from Cincinnati, but I am not able to get him on the phone. Chad wants to ask about the elderly not being high risk and therefore eligible to get the swine flu vaccine. He said, could this be due to exposure in 1918 to the swine flu, or even in the 1970s when that swine flu was? Is that one reason that the elderly may not be seen as especially susceptible?
Yes, it might be. It's very, very interesting that we've seen some degree of immunity among people who are elderly. We don't know exactly why. It's not so much, of course, that they were exposed to what happened in 1918, but it could be that a virus somehow akin to the H1N1 swine flu that we see now was circulating back in the 70s or the 60s, perhaps. It would probably have to be in the 50s, now that I'm thinking about my math. And they might have had, the elderly might have had some exposure that gives them a degree of defense that the rest of us don't have.
Here's an email from Kathleen. She says, if a person has already had the swine flu, would they still be susceptible to catching an avian swine flu combination if you ended up having the kind of resorting that you talked about earlier in this hour?
It's quite possible. Again, there's so much here we don't understand. We're not sure what form a reassortment of swine flu and bird flu, what form that would take. And so it's hard to answer the question, but I certainly would not feel at all confident that you now have a defense against that just because you've been exposed to swine flu itself.
You know, you talked about some of the economic and political reasons that some have sometimes made it hard to fight the development of these flu pandemics, especially in Asia. You also write about some cultural norms that have made it difficult. Talk about those.
Right. There are age-old customs in Asia that contribute to the spread and the amplification of flu viruses, particularly bird flu viruses. One that I have in mind, for instance, is cockfighting. I spent a fair bit of time with cockfighters and in cockfighting arenas in Thailand, and I saw how the cockfighting breeders raise their birds. They have gymnasia or training camps for these fighting cocks. They rub them down. They give them massages. If they get cuts, they sew up their cuts. If they get blood or mucus in their beaks, the trainers will even suck it out with their own mouths. And there are young boys out there, young men who will sleep with their fighting cocks because they're so valuable. And so what you see there is an opportunity for the virus to jump, and we know that it's jumped from birds to people. And the chances of trying to put an end to this custom seem to me almost impossible. It goes back over the centuries. Even in Thailand, for instance, it's even wrapped up with the royalty there. And so it shows how difficult it is to try to get people to take this seriously enough to change the way they live.
In some cases, there are religious objections to steps you might want them to take for health reasons.
Well, there's one example that comes immediately to mind. There's a Buddhist ritual in which merit birds are released. Believers will buy the birds that are in captivity and release them out and give them their freedom. And I saw this again in places like Cambodia and in Thailand, where people are taking birds, species that we know can carry the virus. They'll cup them to their mouths, they'll say a little prayer, they'll give them a kiss, and they'll send them on their way. And I met with a Buddhist monk in Phnom Penh, the capital of Cambodia, who said he had no idea this was the case, but if it was, in fact, he would start instructing his devotees that perhaps they should find a different way to express their religious belief.
Karen in Houston has called us, and she wants to ask, why does the swine flu kill some people and other people just doesn't seem to be that serious a flu?
That's really one of the great mysteries. And there are all sorts of mysteries still with swine flu. We don't really understand why some people are more vulnerable to it than others. We know that this virus can proceed very quickly to a kind of viral pneumonia that can just eat your lungs up. But why it happens in some people and in others, that's still one of the things that researchers are working on. And hopefully, as the months pass and there's more lab work done and there are more autopsies done, we'll have a better understanding.
Alan Cyprus is a Washington Post editor who has written a new book. It's called The Fatal Strain on the Trail of Avian Flu and the Coming Pandemic. Thanks so much for being with us this hour on The Diane Rehm Show.
Thanks so much for having me here.
I want to apologize to our callers. I'm sorry we weren't able to continue going to the phones in this hour, but we'll have that fixed by tomorrow when Diane will be back. I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. Thanks for listening.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR.